I've got to leave it with this one. You'll see.
I know. Coffee with the prime time flow. Time for we accumulate the kinds I know. Me say, Jaggy me, the signs like, whoa. Coffee come in like a rapture. And everybody get captured. Play sleep up like helicopter. When them CD lyrics come chapter.
Patty's is on a fast break with Veggie Patty leading the charge. The pass is down deep to Goat Patty. Goat Patty passes baseline to Beef Patty. Beef Patty shoots from downtown at the buzzer. And bingo! It's in! It's in! Carob Patty's wins the game and is now the world champions! The number one in Montreal. Come on down to 9550 Jean Milo in LaSalle for the best patties, roadies, jerk chicken, and more. Or call us at 438-387-4004. Carob Patties, the champions of Montreal.
There is this thing. Do you realize what is? There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing. On. There is this thing going on. What? Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news brought to you live.
To No One's Legal Radio, part of the CKUT Communities Collective's Off the Hour at 90.3 FM in Montreal, www.ckut.ca around the world. On today's show, we feature an interview with Africanist and Black Studies scholar Yannick Giovanni Marshall. This interview was recorded by Zoom in the weeks after the U.S. election while Yannick was in Africa on the Indian Ocean, which is why you can hear the ocean in the background. We explore a variety of topics, including racism, white supremacy, what Yannick calls white supremacy privilege, the relevance of the politics of Fanon to today, the Black radical tradition, and more. No One's Legal Radio highlights the struggles of communities in resistance with a focus on the self-determination struggles of Indigenous peoples, migrants, refugees, and working-class people of color. No One's Legal Radio is in public confrontation with the Canadian state, organizing to fight against poverty, racism, police brutality, prisons, detentions, and deportations, as well as opposing the displacement and genocide of Indigenous peoples on Turtle Island. We go to that interview with Africanist and Black Studies scholar Yannick Giovanni Marshall right now.
I'm speaking with Yannick Giovanni Marshall. Yannick is an assistant professor of Africana studies, someone who writes quite extensively on the theme of Black studies, on Pan-Africanism. You'll be hearing in the background some waves, and that's because Yannick is speaking to us near the Indian Ocean. Yannick, welcome to No Borders Media.
Thank you very much.
Yannick, I want to start... On this show, we've been talking a lot about the post-election environment, speaking to a lot of different commentators, all coming from an anti-capitalist left position, but with various nuances. You wrote a piece on Al Jazeera, where you often write. The title of the piece was, "After the Election, We Should Not Come Together. Black people would be better spending their energy on international solidarity rather than on reconciliation with Trump supporters." A major theme that we're getting from centrist voices and even liberal voices post-election is that Biden will be a calming influence. There won't be drama, and part of not having drama is to avoid ideological tensions. I guess that's one way of putting it. So let our listeners know about why you feel that. We should not be coming together, and why we should be putting the focus on who's the oppressor and who's the oppressed.
I think that it's unwise to rejoin an alliance with a system, with an institution, with a set of political actors that have throughout history not proven to give us space for an adequate liberation and adequate life safe from a racist violence. If there was 1 hour, or 1 month, or 1 year in the history of white conservatism in the colony that was amenable to black survival, then maybe there could be an argument out from our lives there. But I don't see it as, like, there's nothing in history that points to unity with far-right conservatism anywhere to be useful. But I do think that the liberal argument continues, not based on history, but based on patriotism and a sense of hope that is just blind faith in a system that has proven to be anti-black. To continuously spew this idea that we can be, one day things will change and they will be taken away from their ignorance and start believing in all unity, we're all Americans. And because, first of all, I wouldn't have faith in just for what happened yesterday or the day before to think that there would be any useful unity in the future. But considering the past 400 years, it doesn't seem to be in any reason to actually think that, okay, this time with Biden, freedom is on the horizon. I do think that there should be a removal from this hope in settler colonialism and a thinking of other forms of subaltern alliances, subaltern workers, other, especially in this age where it's easy to be able to speak to somebody across the world, to build imagined communities elsewhere, that those things should be sought out, those things should be built, rather than continuously finding yourself for some reason confined to the local colony. There is no reason to believe that a colony has the redemptive power that it promises, and just by the sense of what the white supremacist colony is. But that plus history should lead any reasonable observer to think that the colony does not allow space for black freedom.
One argument used by liberals, and I'm going to give the best possible interpretation of this argument, and this is specific to the United States, is that first of all, the United States has a procedural democracy that allows for transfers of power. And the argument goes, it's sort of the other side of the coin of the fear of white nationalists, which is the demographic threat that at some point in the next 20 to 40 years, the United States is going to be, whites in the United States will be a minority vis-a-vis blacks and Latinos and other minorities. So this argument, and I would maybe, suggest somebody like Stacey Abrams, the Democratic gubernatorial candidate in Georgia, but somebody who's been identified with black voter turnout efforts. And there's a big focus on Georgia right now because of the Senate seats there and the fact that Georgia went blue instead of red this time around. The argument is that the demographics right now supports a progressive majority, not a revolutionary or anti-colonial majority, but a progressive majority. That is, Latino voters that vote, two-thirds towards the Democrats, black voters, and progressive urban whites are essentially going to be a electoral majority if they can come out enough like they did this time, and the trends bear that out. One argument that's used, for example, is that in the last eight elections, while the Republicans have won several of them, they've only had a majority once out of eight elections in the electoral vote. So what's your response to that argument? Which, I mean, some of the things that go along with that argument is that there should be a focus on voter turnout, specifically turnout of people that white supremacists and white conservatives try to suppress. That is essentially black voters. That electoral argument in 2020 and going forward is a lot different than it would have been in 1960 or 1980 even, there is hope for progressive reforms. And again, as revolutionaries or as people who are committed to a strong internationalist anti-colonial politic, that doesn't necessarily excite us, but that is an argument we have to reckon with. What's your response to that?
My response is, again, I would wonder whether this comes from blind faith or from actual, serious, committed study of the problem. Because for me, if you just would take a cursory glance at black history in the colony, in the American colony specifically, you would see that voting has not seemed to be a solution. In fact, the actual institution itself has been deliberately discriminatory to Black people every step of the way, including the present moment. You find now that there are efforts by this administration to remove the political power of cities that are considered Black cities, like Philadelphia and Atlanta. There are polling places shut down in Black communities. There is the continuous threat that is a mirror of the Klan's threat in the 1910s, 1920s, with the modernized Klan, which is Trump rally supporters going into places to intimidate people with guns. This, if we, in some ways we speak about voting with the presumption that voting is equal to one person, one vote, when voting has been proven in this colony to be not one person, one vote. It has been proven to be that a significant portion of Black people are in some ways dispossessed of that political power, disenfranchised. And so that is the history. To say again, despite that history, that one's faith should be in turning out the vote. Well, if the vote is intimidated, attacked, suppressed, in other ways, destroyed, then that means that one continuously is committed to the invisibility of Black struggle, as only interested in the blind faith of patriotism and the state. And I think that that in itself might be considered racist.
So just to follow up on that a bit, you don't feel that a state like Georgia, which has all those dynamics you talked about, voter suppression. I mean, Georgia is Dixie, right? And the fact that Black women, mainly Black women, leading this this effort to have enfranchisement of the Black vote, and the fact that it did go blue, that's not some sort of major change. That's just one of those progressive things that happens in the midst of colonialism.
One, the electoral, the conclusion of who ended up voted is not the conclusion of who exactly is in the state. Like these are not the exact same numbers. And so next time it could be something different. And so the question that did Georgia go blue always needs to be factoring that Georgia is, we're speaking about the electorate, we're not necessarily speaking about the people of Georgia. So anything can move. People say that Trump actually galvanized the racist vote or the far-right vote, whatever you want to call it. And so maybe next time they can do that again. That's entirely possible. So my argument is that I wouldn't have faith in the electoral system to be a useful avenue towards Black freedom. Because remember, even now, there are still efforts by the administration to overturn Georgia's election, or to there's continuously efforts to overturn elections in a number of different places. And so my worry is that to say that, yes, say Alabama and Mississippi turned blue in 2024, that's still not enough to suggest that, freedom now has arrived. Because we seem to be shuffling from survival in a colonial state, which is still full of mass incarceration, discrimination, and police violence all the time, to the possible fulfillment of the Nazi vision. And so these spaces between survival and catastrophe, these spaces between mass incarceration and possibility of increased migrant detentions and deportations and wholesale overt racist disenfranchisement, that is not sustainable, and that is not satisfactory to anyone that is actually considering Black freedom to be important. So no matter what happens in the electoral system, the colony in itself has proven that it is not amenable to Black freedom. And there has not been given any evidence to kind of to show why we should believe that. The only evidence is faith in the state. And that faith in the state is in itself a faith that the institutions that dispossessed indigenous people and kept people in slavery and continues to be the main institution of anti-Black violence has some kernel of peace and hope in it. Hope in anti-Black institutions aren't best road ahead for Black freedom, I would say.
That's a good place to move into maybe some of the historical or dynamics that you've talked about that account for white supremacy and fascism in the United States. Just a reminder to our listeners that we're speaking with Yannick Giovanni Marshall, who's an academic and scholar of African studies, has written quite extensively on a variety of topics related to Black studies about racism in the United States. The waves you hear in the background are from the Indian Ocean, where Giovanni is speaking from. I'm speaking in Montreal. Giovanni, Yannick, with previous guests, when we talk about some of these topics, you know, we've looked back into history, you know, back to the Civil War, say, the history of slavery. In terms of electoral politics, you know, the insurgency Pat Buchanan campaign in 92 or George Wallace in 68, the fact that there's always been candidates whose appeals to anti-Blackness has gotten a wide appeal beyond the stereotype of white racists in the South, you know, such as with working class white voters in cities like Philly, Detroit, Milwaukee, etc. You have your take, of course, your analysis of our historical understanding of this. One way you've expressed it in the aftermath of the George Floyd uprising is that there's always going to be confusion in recognizing fascism or Nazism in the United States. Those fascists have always been there. They've never disappeared. They're just part of the DNA. They're normalized. So can you talk about that a bit? The fact that, there's this confusion about recognizing normalized fascism in the U.S. and seeing someone like Trump as an exception rather than part of a pattern that goes back to the founding of the United States.
Yeah, if you just look at the mainstream media's speaking on Trump, it took probably years for them to actually say things like, well, maybe this president is racist. And they only say that not very often at all. They would say things like Trump is really revealing himself to be doing things that are past the norm, or that these things are racially charged, or a number of other things. There's always a move to take a detour from what is plain and obvious. The fact that Trump actually started his campaign, one, everybody knows, with the Mexican rapist plan, but also putting Andrew Jackson in the Oval Office, or allowing Andrew Jackson to be put in the Oval Office. And Andrew Jackson is someone that was an advocate for indigenous genocide and slavery. To find his administrators continuously being caught up in white nationalist institutions, etc. All of these things seem to be not enough, even though anyone, a dispassionate and objective observer would say, well, you know what, there might be a racist problem here. It took a number of years, and still, for the vast majority of people, still believe that the 72 million people that voted for this person might be really interested in fiscal policy rather than have a history-long obsession with anti-Blackness and racism in general. And this delay in itself is a delay that allows people to continuously believe in the America is America the good. The colony is always improving. Change will come. Things are getting better, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. All ideas based not in a cursory glance at American history, but based in the propaganda that is the American state. Nazism can be shouted down in other places because, and that works specifically with American nationalism, that America is good and elsewhere is bad. So where Nazism is considered bad, we can see people deriding it in Hungary or in Poland or in the new movements in Germany. But all of these things are separate and apart from American culture. despite the fact that Nazism basically wrote and thought about the American work in elimination, etc. So patriotism, nationalism, and the idea of America always being fundamentally good, coupled with the disregard of Black life, the actual invisibility of Black life, the not being able to think about Black history and tallying it up and factoring it in one's estimation of the state. Those things together make it normal and natural for one to step over the bodies of the colony and say that none of these actually amount to a red mark on the state, that the state is always, regardless, perfectly redeemable, because the destruction of bodies and lives and futures that happen on a day-to-day basis every day in the state do not matter. So racism allows one to believe in Americans' innocence and believe that Nazism doesn't exist here, even for people that would say that they align with general principles of Nazism, just rather not have Nazism itself or say Nazism itself, largely because they would think of it as a German import.
One manifestation of this this conflict is between Black liberals and Black radicals in terms of whether the state is redeemable or not. You addressed this at the height of the George Floyd uprising, actually when the uprising itself was quite young. You wrote back on June 1st, 2020, the title of the article was "Black Liberal, Your Time is Up." I want you to maybe give our listeners a sense of what is that Black radical tradition that has come up against this Black liberal tradition, and how does that manifest itself today?
The Black radical tradition and the Black maroon tradition have always been fundamentally skeptical of the possibility of a Black peace in an anti-Black world, in an anti-Black state. So Black radicalisms have been responsible for the continuance of Black people, the continuance of the existence of Black people. So whether it is gold slaves on plantations or the destruction of the plantations themselves, the destruction of slave masters and slave masters' interests, and making slavery not feasible. Whether it is continuously moving away from hope in joining hands with white supremacists, but also thinking about other internationalisms, say for instance, the Black Panther, think about other areas with which to unite, rather than continuously knocking at the door of one person that is continuously, for some reason, whipping you. The Black radical tradition, the Black maroon tradition especially, one that says that there is nothing in the state that is worthwhile of keeping, that one must be able to move away from the entire institution and to build a life not dependent on that state. And they did this by moving away from the institutions of white supremacy, the quintessential institution of white supremacy, which is a slave plantation, to literally leave from that space. That tradition opens up other possibilities that are not often mentioned in the normalized way of thinking about a race struggle, which is to be able to protest, to ask for change, to turn out the vote, to campaign for white sympathetic ears, and to hope that there will be a critical mass of whiteness that will say, you know what, maybe what we've done to Black people is bad, and we'll make a change. It does not, Black radicalism, Black maroonage, does not typically have the same form of faith in white supremacists or white liberals' ability to change than Black liberals do. Black liberals seem to premise their argument in the future of the white supremacist set of colonial states, its continuance, and in the eventual empathy of the masses of the dominant culture that would result in a coming around and saying, hey, you know what, we've been wrong and we're going to change things. Whereas a Black radical tradition might just look at the state of play as it is and see, wait, there are young white supremacists in every single state on the internet having new forms of white supremacy every day. Where is the sense that there is this eventual promised land always going to an arc that bends towards a peaceable society? There's no evidence for that. There is hope for that, but that hope is also based in a deliberate disregard for history. Black radicals might say, well, I saw what happened to me yesterday and I don't trust them. That's enough. That's a red line. And I don't trust them enough to put my future in their hands tomorrow.
One term you've used is this idea of white supremacist privilege as opposed to just general white privilege. Explain to our listeners what you mean by this idea of white supremacist privilege. You've addressed white supremacy a few times already in your replies. What's this white supremacist privilege, which really prevents us from clearly, or prevents a lot of people from clearly identifying the oppressor and the enemy?
For me, I think what we don't pay attention to enough is the privilege that is given to white supremacists, which is largely, for me, it seems to be the privilege of giving white supremacists the benefit of the doubt. And so the amount of time that it took for people to speak about Trump and Trump administration as a white supremacist, and they still haven't really spoken about it as a white supremacist administration. They often might say that it has racist tendencies, might be a racist president. But the amount of time that it took, always looking, despite all the evidence, despite, and there's countless evidence that almost anybody can point to show links between white supremacist movements around the world and the Trump administration. That amount of time given, that benefit of the doubt given, is something that is reserved specifically for white supremacists. Even white liberals that might say something racist once or twice, they might be shut down. But if it is systematic police violence, if a police union president has a white power badge, if there is consistent violence in prisons, if the vast majority of people suffering from the coronavirus is black and brown, and that might slow efforts to do something about it, all of these things are assumed that no, there's nothing nefarious at play. Whatever it is, maybe it is not as bad as we see, as it seems. Now, that is not often given to black people who are walking in a convenience store. Very often, there is a hyper surveillance of what a black person might do, and to not trust them, and they are innocent, and they are guilty until they're proven innocent. That is not the case for someone that says clearly that this is my African-American, or someone that writes on blogs, that has a senior advisor that writes on blogs to talk about the inferiority of black people. There is still some hope to even call him maybe the tan president, or Stephen Miller as the type of Dracula. All these late night jokes that seem to deliberately skirt the issue of what is absolutely clear. And what is necessary, and sound and objective analysis of what white supremacists have put in place and their power.
I want to give our listeners a sense of, I want to quote back to you, Yannick, something you wrote about white supremacist privilege. You've given a pretty detailed answer just now, but it gives our listeners a sense of your writing style. You wrote, and this is an article that was published on religiondispatches.org. The title of the article was "The Only Common Denominator of American Conservatism is Anti-Blackness." You wrote that white supremacist privilege, as opposed to white privilege, is the privilege, which is to say the power to deny racist intent and always be taken at one's word, to be able to always clutch one's pearls and appeal in Scarlett O'Hara, mint julep inflected tone, "Dearest me, we never intended to," and be believed and remain a symbol of beauty in the world no matter how many scars are on Prissy's back. Now, your corrective, your revolutionary liberatory corrective to what you've described during this interview is, well, there's a variety of things. It's anti-colonialism, it's pan-Africanism, it's internationalism. Now, when contrasting the black radical tradition and the black liberal tradition, one of the caricatured arguments aimed at the black radicals by not just black liberals, but liberals in general and others, is that it's a separatist tradition. It's a tradition that does not seek multiracial unity. Can you address that? And maybe in doing so, address the nuances between Pan-Africanism and internationalism?
Well, first, separatism is not a bad word for me. Again, I'm in support of Maroons that separated themselves from the spaces of white supremacist power. So the move to leave is an option that is for some reason frowned upon, but obviously it was always frowned upon to leave plantations. So separatism in itself is not a bad thing. Obviously, they attach it to movements that are extremely race conscious that they would like to disparage in some way, but to separate oneself from a system of white supremacy is not necessarily a bad thing. It was just definitely not a bad thing. But of course, the colony, with its history of apartheid, of exclusions, of prisons, etc., is a separatist movement. It is a separatist movement that that creates the space for white power, white privilege, white isolation, white exclusivity. It is a place where literal terms that had all over in every single white supremacist colony had a Jim Crow function. So separatism, again, not necessarily a bad word, but separatism is not only the province of resistance movements. It is definitely the invention of white supremacist power and the will to be able to provide and to keep some things exclusively for the white man, literally to call certain colonies the white man's country. Pan-Africanism and internationalism, they could be different forms of the same thing. Sometimes Pan-Africanism is seen to be a state for Pan-Africanism, like an African Union, and I'm ambivalent on that. But in terms of subaltern Pan-Africanism, like the idea of the anti-SARS movement learning from the Black Lives Matter movement, and the Black Lives Matter movement learning from revolutionary activities in apartheid South Africa. This form of community building, of exchange of ideas, might be more fruitful to the cause of Black liberation than knocking on the door, as I said before, of a white liberal or white liberal society to say, if this time is the charm, they will say, you know what, hey guys, we've messed up and things should be better. There's no reason to limit oneself to the cage one was brought into. One can think and one should think outside of all of the limitations that white supremacist power has normalized, and to think outside of their box. And that means where there are other people, especially people that are suffering and resisting the same exact thing that we are resisting, white supremacist violent power, colonial power, then there is definitely a lot to learn from, definitely a lot of shared interests, definitely a lot of common ground that can be built. It's not necessary always to reach into the aisles of people that would support the lynching counties or are representing former lynching counties. That reaching across the aisle might not be as fruitful as reaching across the ocean, or at least reaching across the imagined borders of white supremacist state. There is no reason to be confined willingly.
In the United States, in the American state, there is there are movements like the Republic of New Africa and what have you. So could you maybe address that? Because again, you've made it clear that that word, separatism is something that white supremacists have employed and have weaponized, but it's not necessarily, according to you, it's not necessarily a bad thing when people are trying to separate themselves from white supremacy. But the prevailing argument, I don't think it's just a liberal reaction. I think it's even a reaction amongst radicals, is that we're trying to build a multiracial world, keep taking into account, of course, that white supremacy has functioned most brutally against Black and Indigenous bodies. So can you address that in the American context? Are we talking about that in the American context?
For me, when one is in an abusive relationship, one does not need to have the only option on the table, reconciliation. The only option on the table to continuously living and being and loving in the same space with an abusive partner. One can divorce, one can use divorce, one can separate, one can leave. That should always be on the table. And very often it is the right remedy. And I would say always, it's always the right remedy. And so when it is presented to us that the only option possible is to have a multiculturalism, and that multiculturalism or multicultural world is premised on the continuance or the furtherance of the colonial state, then no, that is not necessary at all. We can imagine differently, we can think differently, etc. So I would suggest that for those people that are interested in building a multicultural, multiracial, equitable world, that is great. Continue to do that. Do what you need to do, but do not expect or want or limit the imagination or the actions of Black people that are tired of this, and to kind of guilt them into having hope or participating in that world building, when the actual worlding of the world, the actual internationalism and community of the world has been premised on indigenous genocide and anti-blackness. It is not that the colony was not multicultural. It is not that the plantation was not built of different races. The problem is that the community of races so far in white supremacist genocidal culture has been a relationship of oppression. So yes, we can hope for a multiracial community and all that good stuff. But I'm saying if it is so possible, then people that have faith in it should go about the business of making it possible to draw people from their sheltering places because of how wonderful it is, rather than invite people before it is started to continue and hope for the best. No. There is a time where we would say that this now has gone on too long, this has gone on too far, and we have no interest in waiting and crossing our fingers and hoping that things will be better. If it will be better, fine, let's talk about that later when it happens. But now we should bring back the possibility of thinking outside of the colony, outside of the state. Sometimes organizations like the Republic of New Africa are just used as boogeymen, or they're used to be able to kind of generalize all forms of disagreement with inclusion in settler colonial violence by whatever flaws this one specific movement would have. But that doesn't make sense. There's a number of ways to leave one's abusive partner. And if one of those ways aren't satisfactory, and I'm not saying that Republic of New Africa is unsatisfactory, but if there are a number of ways, and if there are ways, if those ways have been flawed, if those ways, and I don't use flawed because flawed is the white supremacist liberal magic word, if there are some ways where we have to critically analyze the limits of our problems with our movements away, then that should be done on an everyday basis in every single movement away, every single distancing from white supremacist power. But because one organization imbibed the idea of moving away does not necessarily mean that all forms of moving away are necessarily bad. Indigenous sovereignty, indigenous work seems to move away from the idea of Canada and America as being the dominant and normalized geography. That also, standing in one's place, is still a moving away. And these things should not be thrown away by the boogeymen of separatist movements.
An important point that you've made, and I think it's important to underline it, because I'm speaking to you from the Canadian state. And one real dynamic, you know, we've talked about liberals, Black liberals, liberals in general. There's one particularly annoying kind of liberal, and that is the liberal that doesn't live in the United States. You know, the Canadian liberal, the Swedish liberal, the British liberal that sees the United States as this exceptional racist place. And you've made the observation that the U.S. is not exceptionally anti-Black, but that the entire world is Negrophobic. So could you address that more, so we can move beyond the focus on the U.S., which is important? I mean, there's a lot of interest in that right now, but this more generalized Negrophobia, and maybe the difference, if there is a difference for you between the word anti-Black and the world being Negrophobic. You use that term in an article about how out of the pandemic, anti-Blackness within the pandemic is a plea for Pan-Africanism. You address anti-Black dynamics in China, but you made the point that the entire world is Negrophobic and we shouldn't see China or India or other places as uniquely anti-Black.
Yeah, I think that a better way of understanding the world and race is not so much by reifying the borders or thinking about, okay, well, this country did this and this country did that, but exactly what work of white supremacist power has been, an anti-black work has been done. What is the nature of the strength of the white supremacist movements? Because it is clear that Tucker Carlson is speaking about South African racist farmers. And the South African racist farmers is speaking about migrants in Germany. And Germany is there. Sometimes I'll listen to a London radio program, and they'd be speaking about hoping that Trump wins the election, and that Canadian politicians clearly have been, especially in Ontario, been moving to the right in a number of cases. In my specific case, and there, just not to say there are different differences or different inflections in the type of white supremacist destruction in different places. But I definitely had my first taste of white supremacist work in Toronto, and that has been my that's where I grew up, that's where I saw, that was in a number of ways what radicalized me. I just went to Botswana and saw that the people that thought that they were going to be killed by Mandela's uprising came over to Botswana. So white Afrikaners, a number of them racist white Afrikaners, noted by the school that I went to was filled with only white prefects. And then coming to the America, to America, the American state, and to live among Trump supporters and to see the kind of climate and what was allowed to be spoken there. There are different inflection points in different places, but they all have an imagined community of white dominance, white power, Western civilization, whatever they would want to call it. They all are interested in maintaining white supremacist power. So why would we think in terms of only the national term, to think that American has a specific brand, when this, when the actual people very often have, the colonial governors would move from Kenya to South Africa to America to Ireland. The fluidity of white supremacist bodies and power is absolute. There's no reason that our thinking and analysis can't trace them across any movement. And to believe that there is this type of fictional separation, that in itself, the nation form is largely a white supremacist institution, to be able to confine ourselves again to the imagination of white supremacy, which is a nation state, and to then think that there is something particularly about one invented space that is different fundamentally from another, when the people that invented that native nation space have been moving up and down.
I'd like to ask you about, this is going back to how we began this interview, where you said, you know, I cited one of the articles you wrote about that, you know, this is not necessarily a time of coming together. You don't come together and reconcile with your oppressor if your oppressor is still an oppressor. And you've stressed, you know, making links internationally. You've stressed making links, Pan-Africanist links. I think it goes without saying, of course, that you support the uprisings. You support the resistance that people are putting forward in diverse ways to oppression, to racist oppression. But I'm wondering if you could talk about what are some of those alternative correctives, the Pan-Africanist ones, the internationalist ones that you're addressing, vis-a-vis specifically folks living on the American state with others. And when I ask that question, I acknowledge two things. One is there is a rich tradition of those links being made going back hundreds of years. And secondly, even if those links are small or not well known, that doesn't take away from their importance and their potential strength. So could you give our listeners an idea, some examples of what that style of organizing or what that style of approach would look like or does look like, as opposed to the approach that in one way or another is loyal to the American state?
Yeah, well, there are a number of, I mean, one of the most immediate ways is that you can send actual money in different places in the world. So you can actually share resources. to have a international mutual aid networks. That is always possible. But my when I think about Pan-Africanism and those type of internationalism, I'm actually largely thinking about the symbolic and intellectual exchanges that are possible. So, for instance, when there is a movement against Zionist oppression in Palestine, that also takes some of the symbols and work of Black power activists in the 60s and 70s, or in the present day, then that, like, for example, just calling the Israeli state an apartheid state, obviously there's a number of reasons why that's done, but there's obviously a very strong connection to the anti-apartheid movement in South Africa. Then that buttresses and that clarifies the forms of white supremacist oppression that is in Israel. To say the same thing about Canada as an apartheid state, and to speak about the same reservations and colonial native locations that are happening in, let's say, Manitoba, that happened in places in Nairobi or in South Africa, to look and to see the similarities of the oppression and also the modes of resistance against it. That is an intellectual exchange and a symbolic exchange that can be fruitful. Not to mention the fact that just communities itself, to be in community with people, to see that one is not isolated to the dominant state that is rolling in with tanks in one's neighborhood, that Ferguson is not only alone in Ferguson, but that there are a number of Fergusons all over the world, that in itself has a motivating force for people. So there can be the exchange of material resources. There can be the exchange of other forms of resources, of all forms of talking. But there's also symbolic and intellectual exchange that is, and community that is extremely necessary. But the main purpose in speaking about a type of international or an international, the word is a problem, and or a Pan-Africanist work is to wean ourselves from hoping, in the racist hope, that the American state will provide a satisfactory and adequate and in a timely manner useful freedom ever. That in itself is racist, and it's deeply problematic to believe in the redemptive properties of a white supremacist settler colonial state. And so if we are going to be thinking about community, we do not necessarily have to submit ourselves to the community building with our oppressors. The world is big, we should explore it.
So a final question, and you've been really gracious about the time you've put aside for this interview. A final question is about Fanonism. You describe yourself as a Fanonist, a reference to Frantz Fanon. And I think Fanon is someone that we need to know more about. And I'm wondering, as a way of sort of wrapping up here, if you can let our listeners know about why you describe yourself as a Fanonist and how Fanon's ideas the analysis of Fanon's ideas are relevant today in terms of understanding the things that we've been talking about, specifically anti-Blackness in the United States, building movements that can confront this racism, the various alternatives that we have, the various paths we have, the various imaginations we have, the various imagined communities that we can create. Why the self-descriptor of yourself as a Fanonist?
For me, it's just a useful shorthand to say that I'm an anti-colonialist. And for me, I mean, there's much of it. There is one, for instance, there is a line in The Wretched of the Earth, which is one of the most important books for me, that says that in order to deal with the situation in the colony, we had have to expand Marxism a little bit, so that it's not necessarily the working class that's the revolutionary class, but it's the lumpen proletariat. It is the sub-working class, or the sub-classes that are the revolutionary class. That Marxism has left under-analyzed race and racism and the colonial experience. And so the colony is something specific, and that it needs to be addressed specifically in specific ways. There is a number of different forms of apartheid, different forms of worker oppression, worker oppression that hits certain people differently. So that's why there is the Rand Rebellion and the all white workers of the world unite in South Africa, etc. We need to complicate theories of capitalist oppression through both the colony and through race. And for me, the colony has expanded almost to a global stage. So one, the things that I'm most interested in, Africa, the Caribbean, and the Americas, are all histories with the colony. But the metropoles themselves have taken some of the colonial attributes to themselves. So this is why, for instance, that the banlieue in France pretty much mirrored the oppression in Algeria. This is why Germany and Nazi Germany have learned techniques from the colonial experience of the genocide in Nama and Herero, and Herero peoples in what was called Namibia. So Fanon spoke specifically about the colony, spoke specifically about race in the colony, and how to do away with this form of organizing human life. And it forms a violence, psychological and material, that is visited upon people everywhere. And I find that the world is more like a colony than it is a factory or a global capitalist exploitation. It's not just that. It is complicated with race to the point where 72 million people voted for Trump, not necessarily because they liked the capitalist oppression, but because they were animated by the possibility of racial violence. And so because that is the driving force, this is what Fanon would say, that is because largely the driving force of oppression, coupled with capitalist oppression, that needs to be centered rather than just an afterthought of anti-capitalist work. And so for me, Fanon, for me, is one beginning of one departure from Marxist thought that includes anti-blackness and includes specifically colonial oppression. And that seems to be what has operated largely in the world. Of course, patriarchy, environmental destruction, all these things happen as well. But that is my specific interest in the racism and anti-blackness specific to colonial forms of life.
Yannick Giovanni Marshall, a Black Studies and Africanist scholar and writer, thank you for taking the time to speak with us on No Borders Media.
Thank you so much for this. Thank you.
That wraps up the May 2021 edition of No One's Legal Radio. No One's Legal Radio is part of the CKUT Communist Collective's Off the Hour at 90.3 FM in Montreal, www.ckut.ca on the web. We're also directly associated with No Borders Media. We just heard a feature interview with Africanist and Black Studies scholar Yannick Giovanni Marshall. No One's Legal Radio highlights the struggles of communities in resistance with a focus on the self-determination struggles of Indigenous peoples, migrants, refugees, and working class people of color. No One's Legal Radio is in public confrontation with the Canadian state, organizing to fight against poverty, racism, police brutality, prisons, detentions, and deportations, as well as opposing the displacement and genocide of Indigenous peoples on Turtle Island. Stay tuned for Upstage.
Please note that the following program encounters themes of racial and sexual violence. We invite our listeners who might be triggered by these themes right now to turn down the broadcast. It is CKUT's and the show producer's hope that by covering these topics, this show will spark important conversations and action, and of course, raise awareness.
I will be your narrator. Join me as I guide you through our radio adaptation of Rahul Varma's theatrical production of State of Denial. This is a story of erasure. This is a story of the intergenerational effects of ethnic cleansing. This is a story of the Armenian Genocide. This is a story of Canada. This is a story of reconciling identity, tragedy, and self. This is a story of hope. And of course, This is a story of denial. We begin our story in Montreal in 1996, in front of a small home on Montreal Island. Odette, a young black woman, walks up the steps to the front of the house.
Hi, Reed Cooper spoke to you about me. May I come in? I just returned from Turkey.